Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening and welcome. Whether you're driving home or washing clothes or sitting comfortably by whatever your heat source is with a cup of tea, thank you for tuning in to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, the extended edition. I'm Karen Tate, your host, and that little musical tease was called Nomad's Land from a group I really like called Zingaya. Well, we took a break last week from the show because of Thanksgiving, doing two shows in the same week with Barbara Walker and Genevieve Vaughn before the holiday. And speaking of the holiday, I hope you had a nice one and didn't let the obligations and expectations become shackles to weigh you down. For myself, I like to try to embody the irreverent goddess Babo. I lift my skirts at the tradition. Why? Well, while Thanksgiving was a holiday created as an important symbol of cooperation among people, meant to bring harmony to our melting pot of cultures trying to live here in the United States, the turkey and stuffing sometimes kind of gets stuck in my throat because the idea of the pilgrims and Indians living in harmony is really sort of a farce that we shouldn't continue to perpetuate year in and year out, and really would an insult to our Native American neighbors. The pilgrims and Indians living in harmony was short-lived. In fact, the purpose of the holiday was to negotiate a treaty that would secure land for the Plymouth Plantation for the pilgrims. And it was the Indians, possibly out of their charity, that brought the bulk of the food. So let's find a symbol of harmony, but not at the expense of those who suffered at the hands of European expansion into the New World. Much like the truth of herstory, of a feminine face of God has gotten swept beneath the sands of time, rewritten by the conquerors, calling themselves the civilized and noble patriarchal religions who would do away with those heathens revering goddess, so too did the real history of the indigenous people of America become romanticized and lost as Puritan imperialism and intolerance set out to conquer the Indians and grab their land by any means necessary, including war, genocide, slavery, torture, treachery. I think it's important that we remember the sentiments of gratitude for the bounty of Mother Earth had been practiced a long time on this continent by the indigenous people before the Puritans ever set foot on our East Coast. Let's not forget that the Iroquois contributed to our forefathers' understanding of democracy, eventually resulting in some of those ideas becoming part of our Articles of Confederation in the Constitution. Not to mention they were a tribe where both genders enforced the laws of the village, and women held the deciding vote in many important matters of their tribe. So we have to be careful when we think we know our ancestors, our history, and truth. Let us not be captivated by romanticism or movie making of Hollywood, or particularly let us not be fooled by what we still see even going on today. The patriarchal conquerors who would rewrite history for the sake of their legacies as they whitewash their misdeeds, greed, and exploitation. Anyway, getting back to Thanksgiving, I look forward to the day off. I celebrate, if you will, by remembering and sharing what I've just shared with you about our country's history. And I don't compel myself to fly back home to visit family. Neither do I force myself to make a big, huge meal or do Black Friday shopping. This year, Roy and I rolled out of bed, walked down to a neighborhood restaurant, had a nice meal, and on the way home, we stopped by the beach to say a prayer of gratitude for our bounty at the edge of Mother Pacific. Then we went to see the new documentary that's come out called The End of Poverty. It's a new film that cites colonialism, Christianity, and capitalism as the cause of the last 500 years of poverty. Very fitting, I thought, considering the truthiness of the holiday of Thanksgiving. But we'll talk more about that as well as some other news in our What's the Buzz segment. We're moving to the bottom portion of our show tonight. I'll be sharing more about that movie that got a standing ovation by the moviegoers as well as some other interesting developments in the news. Some of that includes Lamps That Change Color by the Power of Our Mind, Rianne Eisler having received the 2009 Distinguished Peace Leadership Award, World AIDS Day, which was yesterday, and how religion seems to exacerbate intolerance and AIDS. And we'll have some additional thoughts from one of my favorite scholars, David Hillman, author of The Chemical Muse. We started a conversation last show about abortion and ancient priestesses, and I have another installment for you. But I don't want to keep our current foremother waiting any longer. She's been here with us patiently waiting to chat for our Foremothers and Wayshower series, and it's my honor to have her on the show tonight. It's Patricia Monahan. So remember, your calls are welcome. You can call into the show and ask questions. The number is 718-766-4662. And just in case you don't know everything about Patricia, let me give you a bit of her bio. Patricia Monahan is Professor of Interdisciplinary Studies at DePaul University in Chicago and Senior Fellow of the Black Earth Institute in Wisconsin. Her first book, published in 1979, was The Book of Goddesses and Heroines, which is due out in a new two-volume edition this month. She's continued to publish books on the subject of goddess spirituality, including The Red-Haired Girl from the Bog, an exploration of Irish myth and folklore. She's also a poet who has published four volumes of poetry, and she's won the Pushcart Prize for Literature and the Paul Gruchow Prize for Nature Writing. I hope I got that right. Patricia, thank you for being on the show.
And thank you, Karen, for all your good work.
Well, Patricia, tell me first, your poetry, your books of poetry called Seasons of the Witch. Can you explain to our listeners who might not know, why are the seasons an important metaphor for women and for the goddess?
I had the privilege of growing up in Alaska. Please don't mention anyone who's on book tour today to me in reference to that. And there the seasons are very dramatic. I had a friend once who grew up in Southern California and came to Alaska and said, oh, the seasons aren't metaphors, because really there you have a gentle season all the time, so to speak. But when you have winter solstice in Fairbanks, it's been dark for about 4 days. I mean, the sun has not come up at all. Summer solstice, the sky is full of light for weeks on end. The dramaticness of the seasonal change is something that I grew up with and was always really aware of as a really profound connection with the changing of the way the sun moves in relation, the earth moves in relation to the sun. I really felt that these were perfect descriptions of the kinds of feelings we have as we move through our lives. There's been a tradition of the last 30 years of talking about the three parts of the goddess, which, as far as I can tell, really derives from Robert Graves' bringing over of the Christian Trinity into the goddess. I was baffled in The White Goddess when he talks about the three phases of the moon. I think it seems like there's more than three to me. To me, the seasons are a much more vivid way of describing our life cycle, that many people now talk about the four phases of the goddess rather than
right, with the queen. That is the third one now, the queen.
Yes, or, different names have been given to her, but she's the autumnal goddess, you might say. So rather than there being maiden, mother, crone, which always seemed to me kind of an odd selection. And
well, they missed a step in there someplace. You went from giving birth to your life was over, almost.
And those three are very oriented toward others rather than toward the self. But when you think of spring, summer, fall, and winter, that's a natural cycle that people anywhere can understand, even in Southern California. So I have, for many years, seen that the cycle of the goddess and the cycle of a woman's life and the cycle of the seasons all as a sort of parallel set of metaphors. So when I started working on this book of goddess poetry. I was looking for some way to arrange it. My first publisher said, you can't just have a book of poems. It has to have some way that people can get into it. So I made various stacks of poems on the floor for a couple of days. And what I kept seeing was that the seasons were constantly coming up. Of course, having spent much of my life in Alaska, the winter pile was very tall.
Lots of experience there.
Lots of experience in winter. And time to write. So over several editions, I developed a number of sequences within the book that take different goddesses through the seasons. Hera appears, and the Celtic goddess Maeve appears. There's a series called the Goddess Instruction Manual, where you're taught to be different goddesses. It remains.
I'm betting you can even use those for invocations, right?
Oh yes, as a matter of fact, one of the most beautiful moments I think of my life as a poet was when somebody told me recently that she had been attending a dying woman who asked that the book be read to her as she died.
Mm, God, doesn't that make a difference when you know your work is helping people out there?
That was the ultimate.
I bet.
But yes, I love it that the poems are used in lots of rituals and lots of celebrations of various sorts. I don't know that I necessarily was thinking of that when I was writing it, but certainly as the person who for many years has been the one who would be, can you get us a poem for that festival?
now you can just say, buy the book.
Nice to put them all together.
Is the book out yet?
It first came out in 94.
Oh, so this isn't brand new. This has been out there for a while.
No, it came out in 94, then it was republished by Llewellyn in 2000, then it was republished by Creatrix in 2000.
It's still in print now?
Yes, and it's the current edition has lovely little CDs of some of the poems set to music. Poetry and music are very similar. And I think represent the same kind of spiritual connection through the voice, through the breath. Some people think of poetry as lying on the page, and there is a tradition of concrete poetry, for example, which is very visual. But I think of it as very related to music, and I've had the great opportunity to work with different musicians as a lyricist. I did a book of anti-war poetry a few years ago, and Michael Smith, a wonderful Chicago-based folk musician, set a myth from Ireland, from County Kerry, of the mad woman who goes mad because of war, that was set to music as Songs of the Kerry Mad Woman.
I can see that as an incredible one-woman play, too.
Actually,
wouldn't that be awesome?
Jamie O'Reilly, who performed it for the CD, has performed it as a one-woman play, and it is quite hair-raising. And so I've been very pleased when my poetry has been used in those contexts, because I think that that's
ultimate compliment.
my other home is Ireland, and their poetry is still very much more a living culture than here in America. And you know, I remember when I first was over there as a young woman, and someone says, oh, you're a poet. My Uncle Ned's a poet. He writes sonnets. You know, it's like, no big deal. You're a poet.
Everybody's a poet.
Yeah, it's like, you know, that guy and that guy, you know, poets are all around. Whereas in America, poetry tends to be thought of as a more obscure and academic pursuit, and yet, of course, we're surrounded by lyrics. We're surrounded by music, and that is where poetry finds its way into our ear.
Oh, you think about, you know, who can, you know, I'm thinking of the Beatles, you know,
so much
of their music, you know, it's stuck in our head.
Absolutely.
Well, Pat, I'd like you to read a poem or two from your book, but I'd also like you to maybe give one or two examples of the different goddesses associated with each of the seasons, particularly maybe the autumn season, which we're calling now the queen phase.
The Of course, I'm thinking winter here because I'm, you know, we're sitting on the edge of snow here.
That's true. That's true. We've passed autumn, haven't we? Well, I'm in California. Remember, it's always, the same.
it's never quite as dramatic as here on the plains. We're thinking it'll snow tonight. So, I pulled out some poems related to the
okay.
Wintry season.
Okay, go ahead.
So let me read this one. This is called Yule, and it's a prose poem. Each one of the seasons has a poem describing it in terms of a woman's life within the book. So this is Yule. At last, a moment of rest. She coils into herself like a great snake. Her long gray hair falls down over her great body, great looping spirals over breasts that rise like rounded hills over shoulders that jut out like mountain ridges. Her great long hair covers her like a silver waterfall. Deep stillness covers her like night. Dark silence wraps itself into her. Stillness, silence, coil into her, twining together with her long, slow breaths. She could be dead, save for her slow, muffled sighs, for the infinitesimal lift of her vast breasts, the minute flaring of her nostrils. Behind heavy lids, her eyes move slightly. In her dream, chariots descend from remotest stars and burst up through volcanic rock. Women ride behind great black horses across a pale gray sky. Everything explodes with amber light. There is no rest in her dream, but it is ceaseless motion, rocking her into comfort and content until the difference between rest and movement becomes invisible as a dark moon in a winter sky. In her dream of ceaseless motion, she stirs. Her great strong body shifts. Her coiling silver hair falls in great long braids to the ground. She opens, just barely, one eye. A shaft of sunlight, time's amber jewel. The sound of glass breaking into silver shards. And so she begins, slowly, so slowly, to uncoil herself again.
Wonderful visuals. Just wonderful. That's really awesome.
Let me read one more that's considerably shorter. Finding the energetic pattern of each season was really interesting because some of the figures I saw originally as in one season turned out to really fit better in another. And one of those was Snow White, who you might think of as a maiden.
Mm-hmm.
But the loss and the pain involved in that story seemed to be a suitable one for the winter season.
Okay.
So this one is, Sleeping Beauty. Sleeping Beauty speaking to the apple. I held it up solid in my hands, flesh of the tree, dense as rock, gleaming like crimson secrets. It smelled like earth spice. It smelled like dusty water. It smelled like the ghost of roses. Of course I knew it was the apple of forgetfulness, but oh, sisters, how much I needed to forget. The assaults, the betrayals, the abandonments. I did not bite into that fruit in ignorance. This is exactly what I wanted. Stillness, glassy beauty, peace. This is exactly what I wanted.
I like that one, too. Very different.
Yeah, it's very different structurally, too.
But that's definitely sort of a different energetic for Sleeping Beauty.
Yeah, she's a maiden butt.
Yeah, and well, you sort of captured, you know, she's more in control rather than, I think, sort of at the mercy of outside influences there.
A few years ago, I was doing a workshop on the Coleridians, which is a long-lost Christian heresy in which Mary was viewed as divine, very definitely squelched early on. And I was putting together a closing ritual for the workshop, and I was looking for some music, and I realized that the perfect music was Let It Be, speaking of the Beatles, because Mary's words there, Let It Be, can be read as, oh yeah, well, let it happen to me, or it can be, mote it be, you know,
mm-hmm.
so
mm-hmm.
she's making it happen. And when we sang let it be as a so mote it be. It was very empowering. It was really neat.
Absolutely. Well, obviously you've got some great poetry there, but I know you write nonfiction too. What are some of your recent projects?
Well, the day before Thanksgiving, I hit send on a several-year project. I've for the last 7 years, I've been working on two big projects, a total of 5 volumes altogether. One is coming out this month, and that's the completely revised 2-volume edition of my first book, which was called The Book of Goddesses and Heroines, and now is going to be The Encyclopedia of Goddesses and Heroines in a lovely 2-volume edition.
I have to ask you, if you don't mind me interrupting you. I was talking to Barbara Walker and asked her how long it took her to put that encyclopedia of hers together, and she said 25 years. I mean, I would never have had the tenacity. But I have your book, The Book of Goddesses and Heroines, and it's huge, too. I mean, hundreds and thousands of goddesses, it seems like. How long did it actually take you to first compile it?
Well, that's hard to answer because it's actually come out about every 10 years in increasingly larger form.
I see.
Since it was first published in 79 and then it was published again in about 90 and it was published again in about 2000. I think this may be the last one. So
you've covered them all this time.
In that sense, I mean, this one has certainly taken, altogether 35 years. But the first edition was very, very small by comparison. It was only, 250 pages or something. And it came about because I was teaching a class in women's poetry. It was a women's studies class, and we were reading, I remember, Hera Strung from the Sky by Carolyn Kaiser, and this woman said, "Who's Hera?" And I thought, "Who's Hera?" and I said, "Well, she's a goddess." And really the woman said, "Oh, I didn't know there were goddesses." And I said, "Well, they appear in a lot of poetry, so I'll type up a list." So I started typing up a list of goddesses. And every week, as soon as I say, "Is the list ready?" And I thought, this is going on too long. So I went to the bookstore and I said, "I need a textbook for this class. I need like a dictionary of all the goddesses in the world." And they came back to me and said, "Well, there isn't any such thing." And I thought, "What? There isn't any book of all the goddesses in the world? That's ridiculous." So
at your feet.
So I thought, well, I guess I'll just have to write one. And that was the beginning of a 5-year period of living on practically nothing and working part time and pulling all this stuff together for this relatively short book. And then, as I say, every 10 years I would add all that I had gathered. But this time I went back to the original idea, and I thought, each time it's just gotten thicker, but I really wanted to do a complete revamping. And I don't think people ever go, "Oh, I think I'll learn all the goddesses that begin with M." People think in terms of pantheons.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd always wanted to pull it together in terms of the Roman goddesses, the Egyptian goddesses, and so forth. So this is a drastic revision of the book, and I went back to every original source, and I added everything that had been published in the last, 30 years that I could get my hands on. It's also different than the earlier editions because none of the earlier publishers wanted to put in any footnotes, so people would, I'd say 90% of the emails I get are, "Where did fact
mm-hmm.
such and such page come from?" And then I would have to go look it up. So now that's all in there.
Well, that's great.
And,
I started
7 years ago, and I have been working on it full time. It's been my only project for 7 years, and it's very slow.
Well, while it's fresh in your mind, can you think of anything that might be brand new information or something that would surprise the listeners?
Oh, loads and loads of stuff. It's been very interesting over the last 30 years. There's so much more information out about goddess religion. There are lots more original translations. One thing I did limit myself to, all of the sources are in English. Many of the sources then list other sources in other languages, but I figured, you know, it's written in English. The person reading it can read English, we assume, so put the sources in English rather than trying to include other languages. But let me give you an example. There's the first translation of the Caucasian, and I mean that from the Caucasus, sagas about the mother, great mother goddess and her 99 children was only published a few years ago. The sagas of the Norts from the Caucasus. And there are some fascinating stories in there that were completely mind-blowing. The great mother goddess, Setanaya, she is so fertile that she, men, anytime they pass her, ejaculate. and everything around becomes pregnant because she's this, you know, essence of fertility. And there's this just marvelous little story about this woman who seems like she may have originally been a sun goddess, because whenever she puts her pinky out the window, the sky lights up. She lives on a mountaintop in the middle of Caucasian mountains, and she's got a kind of stupid, you know, annoying husband who doesn't really respect her. And he is coming home one night, and she, you know, on the horse that she tamed, wearing the clothes that she wove, and crossing on a bridge of linen that she had manufactured. And he tells her, you know, you don't do really much around here. You know, I really make the living by going out and raiding the neighbor's cattle. And so the next day, when he's coming across the bridge, she just takes her little pinky inside, and it all goes dark, and he falls to his death. And it's like, you know, really, don't mess with me.
Well, you know, Pat, somebody emailed a question, and they wanted to know, how do you explain the similarities or parallels between, for instance, Demeter and Baobo? You know, Baobo making Demeter laugh, and, you know, the world is bountiful again. And that very same story with Amaterasu.
Or the Cherokee, which is almost the same story, where the actually, it sounds almost identical. The sun goddess is weeping for the loss of her daughter, and it's the dancing of young maidens that make her smile, and then the sun comes back. That is something that is beyond my ability to know. I think in the past there were probably lots of people who traveled around and carried stories. Stories were currency. Stories were valuable. There is in Alaska still, in some villages, a memory of the trading of stories as kind of a what you did in the winter. You went over to another village 50 miles away upriver, and you traded stories. Stories were really, they weren't just entertainment. They were ways of teaching, and they were ways of embodying cultural realities. I think they also often had science. I've been doing some work recently. I have a paper coming out in a European folklore journal about the science embedded in some stories, ecological information and warnings embedded in fairy stories in Ireland. I think stories are really valuable. And I think people traveled in the past, and they carried stories, among other things, because there are really otherwise inexplicable parallels. Even probably more startling to me is the story of the incested sun goddess who rips her breast off, which you find in Sri Lanka, and you find it in Alaska, and you find it in South America. Now, how is that going on?
Right.
It's not exactly a story that might archetypally arise from the depths of the human consciousness. It sounds like it must have traveled. And I think that there's a number of versions of the sun being brought back, or the warmth, the goddess of abundance being brought back, particularly by some trickster or by dancing. Yes, definitely a parallel between Uzume in Japan and Baobo in Greece, and then over among the Cherokee you find a similar story, only it's a group of dancing maidens.
But still very similar, as you say.
you know, you get a really good story, and I think you're likely to pass it on. However, tracing diffusion in oral cultures is practically impossible from a, quote, scholarly viewpoint. I think it makes sense that we could assume that these traveled, but I certainly have no proof of that.
Right, right. Well, you know, well, now, do you see a connection between goddess religion and environmental issues and, you know, our current uber consumerism?
Absolutely.
Kind of switching gears a little bit, but I want to, you know, sort of get into this kind of stuff too.
I do. I was doing a good deal of research on a particular figure a few years ago, the cow goddess of abundance, who exists in Irish folklore, not in written myths, but in folklore. And the story is a wonderful one because she emerges from the sea at the beginning of time and walks around everywhere she steps. You know, she leaves the prints from her hooves, and these fill with water, and these are always fresh water, and she gives endless amounts of milk. There's one wonderful story says she doesn't have to have but one calf every 7 years, even with that little bearing, she can, you know, continue to have milk that is filled with butterfat, so you can just, you know, you can live off just her milk. However, then a greedy person decides that they're going to take all her milk, and they start milking her into a sieve. Now, previously, the cow, she's called the glass cow, and previously the cow had filled any bucket that you could bring up, no matter the size, because she was so full of milk. But this person begins to milk her through a sieve, and the milk runs out all over the ground and is lost. And the cow lifts herself from the ground and flies into the air, and the path of her milk behind her is called the Bother Bofina, the Milky Way, which we still see across the sky.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of abundance in many traditional religions, and that includes Native religions of all sorts, including Native European religions as well as Native American religions, abundance did not mean surplus. We have this distorted view today of what abundance means because we're not living in a subsistence culture. We have the ability to store things. Back in the day, you were not storing 7 years' worth of grain because rodents would eat it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you lived on what you could gather, you lived on what you could store through the year, but you were not greedily trying to have everything. And that story is pretty clear that, you know, there is no free milk in Ireland now since the greedy person milked the glass into the sieve, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Greed is actually spoken against in many goddess stories.
We have Sedna, too, the Inuit goddess. She's got that environmental angle in her myth, too.
And a friend of mine, Barbara Shermer, is doing a study of the position of Sedna, the new planet, in charts.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out to be very related to environmentalism.
Like, really?
It's very strong in Aldo Leopold's chart and other great environmentalists. But to go back to the glass, one of the interesting things I found was the word galore, which we use to mean, like, loads and loads, babies galore, you know.
Right.
Whatever is stored today. Its original meaning in the Irish was enough.
Mm.
So we have moved from an idea of enoughness. You know, we have potatoes galore, meaning we have enough.
Right.
To, we have surplus, we have masses of them. And I think that that's a very good sort of nugget of information in terms of seeing another way, that if abundance is enough to be comfortable as opposed to this unsupportable greed. I remember when I first looked at pictures of Dubai about, you know, 7 years ago when they started that massive building boom, I thought, but you don't, that's not an environment that is intended to support ski slopes.
Mm-hmm.
We have been building an unsustainable an environmentally dangerous culture where we are not happy with enough. We want more, more, more.
Well, they said that about New Orleans, too. I mean, and there was a National Geographic article that came out about a year after Katrina, and it said so much of that area was never intended to be developed, but of course, you know, man had to develop and expand, and now look what we have.
Right now, much of the central part of Ireland is underwater. Terrible, terrible floods, catastrophic floods. And Cumbria in England is also suffering from major flooding, and in great part in Ireland, I won't say in great part, part of the problem there is that over the years of the Celtic Tiger, wetlands have been paved over and, you know, new subdivisions have been thrown up in them. And without the wetlands to absorb these floodwaters, they're flooding right into towns. Some very good friends of mine are, you know, in waist-deep water. We have not been living in a sane way, and how we're going to, how and if we're going to be able to make changes, I'm not sure.
Well, and I think it's
a
mistake that we're
not
seeing this too. I'm sorry. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
You know, the coming from Alaska, which is such a vulnerable environment, the glaciers are really. They're melting. You can look at them, and it's like there's a black line around them of melt water. Rivers that would normally be multi-channeled are pouring with water as they go out to sea. It's very frightening. Given the conditions, it's not clear whether we've reached a tipping point or whether we have time to pull ourselves back from the brink. I hope we do, and I think that goddess religion has some messages in the myths that are about honoring nature, and I think that's what we need to do, honoring all of nature and honoring those natural processes. I think it very interesting that Lovelock and Margulis named their hypotheses the Gaia hypotheses when they began to think of the Earth as a full system all to itself, that, you know, it has lungs, it has, you know, heartbeat, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
But there is something magnificently living about the Earth. We aren't treating it very well, and I am definitely one of those that is not a scoffer. I think that humanity has been definitely involved. When you look at the information coming forth from ice cores, well, gee, since the invention of the internal combustion engine, it's been getting warmer.
Mm-hmm.
I doubt that that's a natural cycle, given how far the ice cores go back. I was just listening to something yesterday about the thinning of the Antarctic ice shelf. These are frightening, and it will be the poor that suffer. There are issues of social justice also involved in environmental issues. Can goddess spirituality make a difference? I find in the stories so many really healing images and healing narratives, like the one about the you know, the greedy person who milks the cow.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have a lot of milking of the cow into a sieve going on, wasteful behavior. And if we begin to ask ourselves, in what way are we milking the cow? Can we take personal responsibility? And certainly we can see, you know, national and international responsibility as well. So yeah, I like to think there's some hope there. That's on my better days.
Well, yeah, I have my hopeful days and my days that I'm not so hopeful as well. Well, and I think part of the problem too is there's so much arrogance and hubris about, and I guess it comes from the patriarchal religions, you know, Christianity in particular, that says that you know, man is entitled to you know, to rule the earth, so to speak, and you know, even common sense and science seems to not, you know, deter. You know, this unquenchable, you know, greed and desire for continued growth.
There are things in nature that grow without stopping. They're called cancers.
Yeah.
Everything else, going back to the original discussion of the cycles of the seasons, in the natural cycle, things lie fallow for a while. Looking at the news about the economic crash, you know, people are like, what happened? We should have continued to grow forever. No, nothing continues to grow forever.
Well, you think about just the idea of ebb and flow.
Absolutely. That's nature's cycle. You know, you have, you're not going to be able to have an economy based on growing. Remember not long after 9/11 hearing somebody on the radio saying, it was about 2 weeks later, people are staying home and just buying what they need.
What a concept.
If that continues, our economy is in trouble.
Well, remember Bush said, go out and shop.
And it's true. We have based an economy on excess and surplus rather than basing our economy on sustainability. I'm glad I'm not in charge because I'm not sure how we're going to change this. One thing that I've been working on for the last 3 years is sustainability through local purchasing, local foods. We've eaten our last avocado about 3 years ago because they really don't grow in the Midwest.
So you don't eat anything that has to be shipped in?
Pretty much. Yeah, and occasionally we indulge, but it means a radical rethinking of how you eat because I really just didn't much know what to do with turnips a few years ago. But they grow really well around here.
Well, now you've written some essays on that. Are they available for people to read?
I'm about to launch into redoing my website to where I will actually have all those links on it. I admit to really viewing my computer until recently as a large typewriter. It's telling something of my age. So I'm going to be learning how to actually fix those things so that I get links up, and I'll be doing that on my
website. That's good. That's
you know, I left something unfinished a few questions ago.
Sure, go back.
The other big project that I just completed literally last Wednesday at 5 minutes of noon, Central Standard Time, is a collection of three books, almost 80 essays by different people called Goddesses in World Culture. And each one of the essays is about a different goddess and her position in whatever culture she's from. It's really quite stunning. A great variety of people, Vicki Noble writing about the Dakini, Eleanor Gaydon writing about village goddesses in India. The first volume is Asia and Africa. The second volume is Europe. And the third volume is Australia and the Americas. They're literally scholars from every continent except Antarctica. Just an amazing variety of information. Things that even I didn't know, which was really neat when people come up with goddesses after 35 years of hunting them down. I'd never heard of.
It's nice when that happens, isn't it?
That's actually just gone to press and will be out next year in a three-volume set.
Say the title again.
Goddesses in World Culture.
Goddesses in World Culture. Well, we'll have to look forward to that for sure.
It brings it right up to the present with essays on contemporary Dianic religion. A really wonderful essay on goddesses in video games.
Oh, okay.
Which is not where I would have started looking for them, but they're there.
Okay. Well, that sounds interesting. You piqued my curiosity. Did anyone write on Sekhmet in Egypt? She's one of my favorites.
Actually, we have two Sekhmets in a way. We have Normandy Ellis wrote about Sekhmet Hathorn Bass in Egypt, but Anne Key wrote about the Sekhmet Temple here in America.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
There's wonderful resonances among the different essays. Betty Meter, the wonderful translator of Sumerian work, she wrote about Nisaba, the goddess of grain and writing. Judy Gran wrote about Indian goddesses. Just a wonderful, wonderful collection of essays. And I learned lots, and it was a pleasure to an honor to work with these different women.
I bet. Well, it sounds like it'd be great.
Men
contributors too.
Yes.
Well, you know, getting back to the environment, and you were talking about sustainable living a minute ago. You have a gardening project, a vineyard?
Yes, vineyard, orchard, and organic acre, in which we raise most of our vegetables. The vineyard may sound a little odd for Wisconsin, and I know, you know, your listeners down there in California are you know, driving off the road in hysteria at the idea. But every so often, you know, your global warming can work to our advantage. No.
Okay.
There are actually two kinds of grapes that grow in the upper Midwest, some fairly old heritage varieties that were bred in Alsace-Lorraine after the phylloxera epidemic in the 1800s almost knocked out all the vineyards in all of France. Botanists began breeding very hardy American vines with European vines and creating these hybrids. They're much more vigorous than your typical vinifera grape, like your Chardonnay or a Merlot. These are really hardy vines. They have the American hardiness, and then they have the European taste. They are now outlawed in France because they are hardier than the French grape. But there are some that are still... that still can be grown. So some of the grapes are Leon Malotte and Maréchal Foch and other heritage French-American varieties. But the majority of them are new, new from the breeding program at the University of Minnesota, where they are breeding grapes hardy to 41 below, and they are extraordinary. This is, you know, changing the face of grape growing in the Midwest. And our farm in Wisconsin is on an extremely steep, rocky hill, and after looking at it for some years, going, what grows on steep, rocky hills? What grows on steep, rock? What grows? Duh! And we're 6 miles from, in each direction, from the biggest vineyards in Wisconsin, so it seemed fate that we would put in grapes. But grapes have turned out to be more than just a really fascinating plant that, you know, is quite demanding. The mythic resonances of the grapevine. We have taught ourselves to make wine, and this is experiential learning of a major sort. But I remember the first time I had some wine that wouldn't clarify. It had this kind of like gray haze that was sitting in the middle of this beautiful Sauvignon Blanc, and I couldn't get rid of it. And so I started doing research on clarification, and I found that you can do a whole bunch of things like, you know, filtering it and stripping a lot of the flavor out and so forth. But basically, one way to do it is to just chill it. So if you want to get things clarified, chill, baby.
I like that. That's cute.
And I remember sitting in a faculty meeting the next day and thinking, you know, we got to chill here.
get it tattooed and embroidered and put it on the wall.
There are a few people I could have tattooed it on. The idea of the clarification is not is a real physical process. It is not just an abstraction. And I saw it happen. So I put it in the basement, and within a couple of days, it had entirely clarified. And I'm like, oh, clarification means something.
Aha, one of those aha moments.
The world of wine is filled with that. Another example is I'm out there pruning, you know. Pruning takes a lot of time and energy. And, it, you know, an old phrase from the Bible comes to my mind. I am the vine, you are the branches. And I stood out there in the vineyard laughing because I had been misapprehending that as someone who did not grow up with vines. I mean, the Bible is filled, drenched with wine imagery because they had vines around.
Right.
I always thought that I am the vine, you are the branches was sort of like, it's a tree.
A family tree or something.
You know, we are all part of one. Nah, the branches go, the vine remains. Branches are just, you know, they're going to be cut off and thrown away. Actually, what that means is that I stay, you pass through.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Completely different meaning than
originally. Well, you know, there's something to be said for actually, what do they say? It's like being in sales versus operations, you know, the operations of people actually have to do it. You know, they know the reality of the situation.
Yes, yes.
Well, Pat, we have about 10 minutes, and I wondered if you wanted to spend that talking about the Black Earth Institute or the Association for the Study of Women in Religion.
Well, we'll squeeze in a little bit of both.
All right.
The Black Earth Institute is a 5-year-old institution that was founded in response to the growing awareness that arts in America are seen as part of commerce. You know, you are judged according to how much you make, how famous you become, celebrity, commerce, money. And yet the arts traditionally, and in almost every society, have been related to religion.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
I'm a great fan of the book The Dancing Goddess Toward a Matriarchal Aesthetic by Heidi Gutenberg Abdras, who gives this very strong kind of Marxist interpretation of commodification of art, but then also paints a picture of what life would be like if the arts were decommodified and became part of the process of culture. It's a marvelous book. And the arts really are and should be part of the spiritual quest and part of the religious life in the greatest sense. So on our farm in Black Earth, Wisconsin, we formed an institute where we have at any given time about 10 distinguished writers. We hope to expand eventually into other arts as well. But we bring people together for essentially like a graduate school intensive once a year where we study various relevant things. We've studied the period of the Great Awakenings in American history. We've studied the philosophy of George Lakoff. We've studied Native American oracular traditions and so forth. We've, you know, over the years been studying a number of different aspects of the oracularness of art. And we also present programs. We've been at the American Academy of Religions. Some of our fellows will be at a big conference in Brussels in a couple of months on a spirituality and art. We've been at the American Folklore Society and so forth. We are reaching out to articulate a vision of art that is not necessarily non-commercial, meaning we don't expect everybody to be a starving artist in order to prove their worth as an oracle, but that a vocabulary that talks about art in a religious and spiritual sense. It's been really thrilling. The website is www.blackearthinstitute.org.
Okay.
And the other organization is brand new, about to emerge from its period of pregnancy, which is the Association for the Study of Women and Mythology as Women, which is womenandmyth.org. And this has been in the works for several years, about 3 years. It grows out of women who have been meeting relatively informally under the name Goddess Scholars, from which is related to the Goddess Scholars email list, which has been around for close on to 10 years now. The Goddess Scholars meetings have been held for about, I was going to say, maybe 8 years as part of the Reformed Congregation of the Goddess Priestess Gathering in the spring in the Wisconsin Dells. And about 3 years ago, we decided that we would begin creating a standalone academic organization, organization for scholars and artists both, that would bring together people who wanted to examine goddess spirituality. And we're going to have our first national conference in April in Pennsylvania. I'd like to say I know what it will be like, but we're still now organizing it. Christina Biaggi, Christina Eisenberg, and Ann Philmeyer are the keynote speakers, and our subject is the Green Goddess, ecology, eco-spirituality, and goddess religion.
Certainly appropriate.
Pardon?
Certainly an appropriate topic.
Yeah. Ever so much more.
Mm-hmm.
Not everything will be about that subject. There will be, you know, there'll be our overarching theme, but we'll have, you know, we're open to papers and presentations. We're going to have films. We're going to have, you know, readings. There'll be a whole lot of different activities. But our main goal is to begin to put out a forum for women who are doing goddess scholarship to talk to each other. I should say people who are doing goddess scholarship. To talk to each other and in a critical and supportive way. There are events for women around the goddess, but they tend to be religious gatherings
mm-hmm.
As opposed to academic gatherings.
Right.
Some few years ago, a few women tried to get a goddess group established through the American Academy of Religions, but that didn't come about. There is a pagan studies group now through that organization, but we really want to have a place where we can see 50 or 80 papers on goddess studies once a
mm-hmm.
year.
Right.
At this point, our plans are to meet biannually in a national meeting that will move around. It'll be in the Midwest next year, or 2 years from now, and then on the West Coast 2 years after that. And then in the interim times, there will be regional gatherings.
And people can get more information about that at womenandmyth.org.
Yeah.
And is the AND, Women and Myth?
Yes.
Okay. Well, Pat, we're about out of time, but if you can encapsulate it in about 2 or 3 minutes, you know, you've been around the goddess movement for 3 decades. Where do you see it now? Where do you think it's going?
You know, about every 10 years, right about when I'm usually redoing Goddesses and Heroines yet again, which I'm not going to do ever again, I hear that, you know, the goddess movement is dead. That's so yesterday, you know. Nobody cares about that anymore. And, you know, I've been around now long enough where I'm sure there's at least 3 times that the whole thing has been declared dead.
Mm-hmm.
Most recently, of course, there's been, you know, a fairly large backlash. You know, it's unscholarly. We're all
feminist fantasies.
Deluded by the idea of ancient matriarchies, blah, blah, blah. So now I've gotten to where when that happens, I think, aha, there's going to be another large amount of interest coming forth, because it seems right after, you know, the whole thing is declared dead, suddenly a whole bunch more interesting books come out. And
so are we on the resurgence or the ebb?
I think we are beginning another resurgence.
Okay.
At least I hope so. And I think that the tie-in with environmentalism is something that I see happening in this resurgence that I didn't in earlier ones. Most goddess women that I know and have followed really came out of feminism. You know, there are some women who are brought in by other means, but feminism is an important underlying principle.
Mm-hmm.
There have also been alternative culture people who come in, people who are interested in seeing in remaining within our traditional church while bringing in goddess imagery.
Mm-hmm.
There's a huge diversity of women and men in the goddess movement. It's not where it was a number of years ago, where it was a very odd, strange thing. Now, there are now, you know, Unitarian goddess women. There's, you know, lots of Catholic nuns who, you know, bring in woman church and feminine imagery. There are Jewish women. You know, even within monotheistic religions, there is a greater attention to the feminine face of God. I don't think it's going away.
I don't think so either.
Seeing,
I think we've all planted a lot of seeds, and they're sprouting up everywhere.
And, you know, now, as I say, every 10 years or so, I hear it all declared dead again. Oh, that goddess stuff. don't.
Well, what's old is new again. There you go.
She doesn't go away.
Well, thank God us.
Yeah.
Well, Pat, it has been great having you on the show. You've shared some insightful stuff, and I really appreciate you taking the time. I know it's later on the East Coast there, and you're probably tired after the hard work you've been putting in to get those volumes finished to the publisher. But so I thank you.
And keep up the good work yourself, Karen. It's very important.
Well, thank you. Well, I just wanted to tell you, you're welcome to stay on the line if you like. I'm going to mute you, though, because I'm going to do the bottom segment of the hour. It's going to be the What's the Buzz segment. But please feel free to stay on if you like. And thank you so much for being on the show. Did you? I know you said your website is in process at this point.
Well,
it just needs...
Updating. A lot of stuff needs to be added, but it's patricia-monahan.com.
Patricia-monahan.com. Okay, well, that way our listeners can go take a look and watch it as it evolves.
Thank you very much, Karen.
Thank you so much. So if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just might save the world. Seriously. And we've been talking to Pat Monahan tonight. I hope you've enjoyed that part of our show. And now I hope you'll stay with us because at the bottom of the hour, I'm going to have our What's the Buzz segment, which so many of you have emailed me saying you really enjoy and look forward to. So first of all, let me start off with, as I promised, I wanted to mention the world's first lamp that changes color with the power of your mind. Caught my imagination because it reminded me of the power of our magic or our intention and our prayers directed at a source or a subject to make change in our lives. Well, thanks to over 27 years of research at the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Lab and a company called Siluron, we now have a lamp that reads our minds. This came out of a program that examined what happens when humans interact with machines. Short version of this research shows how conscious intention and meaningful emotion alter the color of the lamp so we have more evidence how our thoughts can affect the physical world. The lamps move through the colors of white, red, orange, yellow, green, cyan, blue, purple, and magenta until they're influenced by the conscious or subconscious intention of consciousness. I thought that was pretty cool. A lot of us already knew that anecdotally and intuitively, and now science is catching up. Next up, moving on to ancient priestesses in Greece and abortion. We started this talk on our last show about how the ancient priestesses were some of the last thorns in the side of Christian patriarchs as they tried to change the religious and social order, which included the oppression of women, with the abolition of abortion being one of the ways in which women were kept under control. Well, here's the next installment from my good buddy, scholar David Hillman. He's author of The Chemical Muse, and this is what David said I could share with you tonight. No single woman invented democracy, nor did any wealthy politician, educated philosopher, or any men at all. According to the remains of ancient Greek culture, the rule of the people was the product of a sacred voice uttered by generations of young priestesses, yes, oracles, whose poetry inspired generations to fight for freedom against the rule of aristocratic tyranny. In a world where money forever corrupted governance, the ancient Greeks found a truly incorruptible political force, a form of immensely practical wisdom that eventually brought the Western world the scientific method, the stage, and democracy. The classical world discovered the power of nature and used it to preserve and defend personal freedoms. Their recipe for liberty was beautifully simple, and this is what it was. Take one teenage girl about to enter puberty, teach her to dance, teach her to sing and compose poetry, teach her astronomy. Surround her with women who can instruct her in the use of drugs to control her fertility and relieve her pain. Let her drink from the sacred spring, and then ask her any question. Well, the Greek word for history was originally, quote, a question submitted to an oracle, unquote, Now, how many of us realize that, that the definition of history was a question submitted to an oracle? That's right. For the founders of democracy, history was an immortal wisdom manifested by young women, often the best educated and talented teenage girls who were trained by the most drug-savvy health professionals of their time. They were taught by temple priestesses how to dispense drugs for life and death, for healing, and yes, for abortion. According to David Hillman, their talents could make any modern doctor blush. These young women, with the aid of powerful and complex hallucinogens, integral to sacred rituals and performances, could lower the veil to the divine and look to the stars for answer to life's questions. For centuries, young Greek priestesses presented their voice to the Greeks in the form of political judgments, with complete authority to make or break any ruler, and they even had the power to order the execution of perceived tyrants. These youthful girls, living across many centuries, spoke with stunning unity against oppression in all its forms. Under their guiding voice, democracy was born. Christianity eventually labeled these women witches and vigorously persecuted them in an attempt to silence their fierce and unifying opposition to the rise of an anti-democratic patriarchy. Church leaders began one of the oldest Holocaust known to humanity, the ramifications of which still stifle the female political voice. Well, David Hillman will be returning to the show to chat with us in either February or March. I forget. I don't have the calendar in front of me. He's brilliant and more knowledgeable than most. You'll have lots of questions for him, no doubt. And I love how he turns what we think we know about history on its head, and he makes us really realize we don't even know all the questions, much less have all the answers. So I look forward to having David on the show so we can have a nice conversation. Well, this talk about witches perfectly segues us to more news about witches around the world, good and bad. First, if you haven't heard, a Saudi Arabian court sentenced a TV personality to death for witchcraft. Human Rights Watch, an international watchdog group, yesterday sent a letter to the Saudi Arabian Court of Review asking them to overturn a lower court's death sentence for a Lebanese national. The man, Ali Sabat, was arrested last year by religious police while on pilgrimage to Mecca. His crime? Witchcraft. Sabat is a television personality who often gave advice on general life problems and made future predictions on the Lebanese satellite TV station, Scheherazade. Apparently, that was the basis for the charge against him. According to his attorney, Sabat was not allowed to have a lawyer at the trial and was coerced into making a confession with interrogators, promising that he would be released if he did so. He was convicted of witchcraft on November 9th and is currently in jail awaiting execution by beheading. And he's not alone. Human Rights Watch says two other people were arrested in similar charges in just the last month. Sarah Lee Whitson, Middle East Director at Human Rights Watch, said, "Saudi courts are sanctioning a literal witch hunt by the religious police. The crime of witchcraft is being used against all sorts of behavior with the cruel threat of state-sanctioned executions." Others have been executed for this type of crime before. In 2007, Saudi Arabia beheaded a pharmacist, Mustafa Ibrahim, for having tried to separate a married couple, quote, through sorcery, unquote, according to the Ministry of Interior. Saudi judges have harshly punished confessed witches for what at worst appears to be fraud, but may well be harmless acts. Saudi judges could not have the power to end lives of persons at all, Whitson said, let alone those who have not physically harmed others. Human Rights Watch has repeatedly urged the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to codify its criminal laws and bring them in line with international human rights standards. Currently, the kingdom has no penal code, and judges have almost complete discretion to define criminal acts and set punishments for them. I want to thank Mary Eileen for sending us that article. And second, but more powerful, positive for witches, in Taiwan, there's an effort to bring back witches within their social structure. The government is funding a program to help indigenous tribes preserve traditional practices. For the Paiwan tribe, that includes training women as witches or spiritual mediums. They're seen as being somewhat of like a counselor for the tribe, providing comfort in times of trouble, and they led the community important ceremonies and were thought to help protect the village from evil. One of the witches interviewed in Taiwan had this to say. and this is her quote, "Our type of witchcraft is not wild like the media have imagined it to be. It's based on life. For instance, if we are about to plant seedlings, the mediums or witches conduct a prayer chant for planting. Before a harvest, we have a chant to pray for a good harvest. During funerals, we have a chant for mourning." Community leader Wang Yuha and others believe it's especially important to pass the witch's skills on to the next generation. Elder witches learned the chants by memorization in the past, but now they're trying to record them, and they've organized a class after obtaining funding from the Council of Indigenous People with Taiwan's central government in order to actually go ahead and record these chants. The women attend the classes, which cost $18 for 36 hours, with understanding that the teachers can't instill psychic powers in the students, but simply help them try to discover it within themselves. Students also must have witches or shamans in their bloodline or be the offspring of village chiefs. The spokesman for the village said that in the aftermath of the recent typhoon, which brought severe flooding and mudslides, killing more than 600 people, she and a witch from her village used traditional chants to comfort villagers whose homes had been washed away. And she says, "I'm very happy to be learning about all of this. If my ancestors knew, they would be very happy too." And I want to thank Laura for sending that notice in to us to share here at What's the Buzz. Well, I mentioned at the top of the show that my husband Roy and I appropriately spent Thanksgiving at this new documentary that just opened in selective theaters across the country called The End of Poverty by filmmaker Philip Diaz. Well, I reviewed it for my Examiner.com column because while the subject, you might not think it's sexy or titillating, it's so very important people understand what's going on out there in the world because it seems to be occurring right here at home too, not just in some faraway place we can turn a blind eye to. It's also important because goddess spirituality speaks to the needs of the many, not to the desires of the few, the elite, the rich, and most powerful to steal from the poor. That makes this new documentary, The End of Poverty, opening this week in Los Angeles theaters, must viewing for not just goddess advocates, but people everywhere concerned about justice, fairness, and equality across the globe. So I want to tell you a little bit about the film and highly encourage you to look for it in your neighborhoods. At one point during the film, they interview a Maasai tribal elder, and he explains the loss of his ancestral land, saying, quote, "They came with guns in one hand and a book of deception, the Bible, in the other," unquote. Well, that's been the modus operandi for the last 500 years as European colonialism, Christianity, and capitalism catapulted billions into poverty and keeps them there. Colonialism steals the land of the indigenous people, Christianity steals their spirituality and the foundation for their culture, with the coup de grace, or death blow of capitalism, stealing their resources, jobs, and hope for a sustainable future. Only the coup de grace is without any mercy. Well, this filmmaker, Philip Diaz, shows up close and personal the human cost of capitalism. He shows over and over from country to country with a variety of expert talking heads, including Nobel Prize-winning economists, and the real people talking candidly about their suffering, the gross inequality of capitalism between rich and poor, between the industrialized global north and the underemployed global south. He informs us how privatization of natural resources, which are the gifts of Mother Earth, are being exploited by corporations, making it impossible for people in third world countries to even afford to buy clean water. He knows how these indigenous people, victims of corporations in collusion with their governments, have had their ancestral lands stolen, leaving them no alternative but to be little more than slaves. Barely able to afford to live in 7-by-7-foot shacks, they must rent for more money than they earn. We see how these working poor, when there is work, must choose between feeding their children one meal a day and keeping a tin roof over their head. Most have no sanitation or educational opportunities. Health care is rarely affordable. Often they turn to prostitution or breaking the law to have money to buy food. And we see how these conditions of hopelessness and inequality breed not just violence, crime, and unrest, but terrorism. Diaz, the filmmaker, lets us hear firsthand from former CIA associates how the Central Intelligence Agency kept the capitalism machine well-oiled with threats and bribes. any third world leaders who objected to the exploitation of their people and their country's resources, who couldn't be bought off with millions of dollars to support the status quo, would be subtly threatened with assassination or being removed from office by rebel coups financed by corporate and government interests. A case we can all relate to. We're reminded how a young Saddam Hussein was once employed by the CIA to help oust the then leader of Iraq. Then we all know he took over power in Iraq, then got on the wrong side of the United States' interests, and the rest is history. We have companies like Halliburton, who are war profiteers with no-bid contracts, raping the American treasury as they rebuild Iraq's infrastructure, which the current and needless economics-driven war destroyed. Well, you know, it's a pretty sweet deal. You pay them to tear it down, and you pay them again an outrageous price to build it back up. And with privatization, the jobs don't go to the starving locals. The jobs go to employees brought in by the corporation, leaving the indigenous people of the land in poverty with their economies in ruins. And in the case of Iraq, Americans have their treasury robbed, and few in power are talking about this. Yet, despite the obvious failure of capitalism for billions across the globe, we hear more of the same, that deregulation, more privatization, and tax cuts for the rich will eventually trickle down and fix the problems that capitalism created. Well, I think not. It's proven that upwards of 1 billion people live on a dollar a day or less. As many as 16,000 children die daily from malnutrition. People of sub-Saharan Africa, the poorest region of the world, spends $25,000 every minute paying off their massive debt to the richest countries in the North. The number of people suffering from malnutrition has increased since the 80s, doubling in the last 40 years. The World Bank estimates the Third World spends $13 in debt repayment for every dollar in grants received. These people are constantly in debt to the company store with no hope in sight to get their heads above water, and those in power seem to want to really keep it that way. And here at home, do we have to be reminded of our current economic situation? In the United States, we're suffering the worst economic conditions since the Great Depression, and why? Most say our current problems are due to deregulation of the banks and Wall Street turned casino with everyone's money, yet corporate CEOs who created the mess have suffered little or aren't held accountable and are still getting huge bonuses, while average Americans have lost their homes and jobs. Are Americans the next targets of capitalism run amok? We might ignore it happening in Africa or South America, but what about when the hounds of capitalism are snarling on Main Street at your front door? Well, this documentary, The End of Poverty, it's easy for the average person to view and understand. You hardly have to be an economist to follow the story. The movie starts at the beginning. We see how poverty was created by European and Northern powers' relationship to the global South from 16th century colonization when Spain and Portugal first came to the new land. They obliterated the indigenous people's wealth and culture. Between 1503 and 1660, the precious metals stolen from the New World by the Spanish increased the European silver reserves fourfold, funding a massive expansion of imperialism. It takes the moviegoer forward to today's globalization, showing the plight of the poor around the world, citing the World Bank, IMF, corporations, and government, all working together to ensure the system continues. Well, I have to share with you, as we sat in the Culver Plaza Theater watching the movie around Thanksgiving, happy to see so many had come to witness this film when there was certainly lighter fare to be had that might have allowed them to keep their illusions intact, I honestly felt hopeful. I felt even more hopeful when they were clapping at the end of the movie and a standing ovation was right there in the works. People care. People want change. More people need to know about this. I kept thinking about those teabaggers we see on Fox News, thinking if they could see this film and appropriately direct their frustration, mistrust, and passion, that would be a great thing. But I have to also say it wasn't long before sober reality hit home. I started thinking no one man, even if he is the president of the United States, can fix this huge problem. And if he should protest too much, if he should demand the changes he promised the people to whom he gave so much hope, he might meet the same unfortunate end that so many of those third world leaders who wanted the exploitation of their people to end. I guess if there was a drawback to the movie, there wasn't enough focus on how to fix the problem. Perhaps the filmmaker wanted to live another day to do his next film about Karl Marx's book, Capital. He might also have focused on the Catholic Church, I thought, their inability to put science and human suffering before their dogma, namely in their preaching against the use of condoms in HIV-ravaged Africa and impoverished countries where birth control might help the plight of the hungry and poor. Still, go see this movie. Think about the subject. Tell your friends. Allow it to open your eyes and heart, and the next time someone extols the virtues of capitalism, think about the human cost. Well, again, that movie was called The End of Poverty with a big red question mark. Think again. Well, that segues us into our last What's the Buzzer zinger, how religions exacerbate not only the AIDS crisis but intolerance. We've talked already about the intolerance of the Puritans toward the Indians whose land they coveted, and they felt entitled to take the land because, after all, the Native Americans were other. They were heathens. They were of the devil. The early Puritans were very intolerant. Remember the Salem witch trials? Remember that great book and movie, The Scarlet Letter? Well, fast forward us to today. As I already mentioned, we have the Pope speaking out against the use of condoms in countries where people don't need extra mouths to feed, where AIDS is rampant, and evangelicals, a famous one right here in California, Rick Warren of the Saddleback Church in Orange County, well, his pet project in AIDS-riddled Africa includes ties to a man who publicly burns condoms in the name of Yahweh. This is also the church that tells women grounds for divorce or adultery or abandonment, but not abuse by their spouse. And let us not forget good old Sarah Palin's church at war with the Queen of Heaven, who they call a demon, and her support of that Christian minister in Africa who was a witch hunter. Well, now there's another American Christian political organization called The Family, who's in collusion with government officials in Uganda, considering a law which should send known homosexuals to prison for life and require those who know gay people to turn them in. And if they're chronic homosexuals, well, they'll be beheaded. And can we forget the radicals who believe they are all justified to kill doctors who perform abortions? This is insanity, not what their Jesus intended. So, with yesterday being World AIDS Day, let us not only reaffirm our commitment to health care for everyone everywhere, but also against religious persecution and dogma that turns people against one another, that entitles a person from one religion to kill another. Let us not forget these injustices are still crimes, inhumane and unjust, even if you hide your bigotry and hatred behind a holy book. And fundamentalism, no matter what religion, culture, or nationality, is dangerous. So that concludes a rather extended version of What's the Buzz for another week, and the bees, whew, are released from my bonnet. And if you're wondering why I consistently have this segment opening or at the closing of each show, well, it's because the programming has been so pervasive. The fearmongers and intolerance seem to have ratcheted up their dogma. We have to constantly educate, whether we're educating about women's issues or religion or human issues. We have to inoculate ourselves against ignorance, intolerance, and those insidious isms. We have to stand up, in this case for women's reproductive rights, in the matter of abortion that's in the news every day, it's health care. Can you imagine the powerful priestesses of ancient times being told what they could or could not do with their own bodies? It was these priestesses whose voices strongly challenged that new religion of their time called Christianity. Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning in. And as I come to a close, I want to just add a few last announcements. I'd like you to know that I'll be giving a talk on sacred places of goddess around the world in January at the Sophia Temple, otherwise called Olindar, the home of Carla and Lee McCloskey. I invite you to visit the media page of my website and catch the radio interviews I'm invited to do. In the next couple weeks, I'll be interviewed by a station in South Africa, and I'll be talking about the sacred feminine as a deity archetype or ideal for a sustainable future. I invite you to go to my website at KarenTate.com. There are free downloadable meditations there. While you're there, get to know me better. Check out my books. Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, has garnered prestigious endorsements. And my second and more recent book, Walking an Ancient Path, won a place as a finalist in the USA National Best Books of 2008 Awards. And the scholar David Hillman, who I've quoted on the show tonight and last week, reviewed the book, and he remarked that Walking an Ancient Path is an immensely pleasurable and enlightening journey that stands boldly against the patriarchal denigration of the divine feminine. And I have to say, I'm proud about that endorsement. Please go to my events page, see if I'm appearing in a town near you, see what talks I have available to give your group, check out my articles and links page, referring you to people and groups around the world making a difference, and consider taking advantage of the offer I have on my website in the Goddess Store. Both my books are $25 plus shipping and handling. And to keep you updated on the currently running Four Mothers and Way Showers series that airs through March, we've just booked Christina Biaggi, Heidi Gottner-Abendroth, who edited the new book, Societies of Peace, Matriarchies, Past, Present, and Future, which everyone's been talking about, and Michael York, who just presented at the American Academy of Religion, who will be at the Parliament of World Religions. His topic on the show will be Men Who Love the Goddess. So if you're new to Voices of the Feminine here on Blog Talk, we take your caller questions. You can also email in your questions. If you can't listen live or don't want to be on the air, you can always email me some of your questions. So I'd like to say goodnight for another week, and I'll leave you with a song from one of our artists. Why don't we try Persephone Rising by Flash Silvermoon. Good night, and thanks for tuning in. Hope you'll be back with us next Wednesday night at 6 p.m., when my guest will be Charlene Spretnak, followed by Rhianne Eisler on December 16th, Eleanor Gadden on December 23rd, and Isaac Bonowitz on December 30th. Good night.